Hello everybody and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Global Logistics and Supply Chain Practice Head for Morgan Phillips. My job is to connect you with global experts, thought leaders and executives in all things supply chain. I will do my best to pick their brains on supply chain and logistics leading edge technologies, leadership stories and personal success habits. Hello everybody and welcome to episode number 6 of Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. My name is Radu Palamariu and I'm the Global Head of Supply Chain and Logistics Practice for Morgan Phillips Executive Search. We are delighted to have together with us today Bjørn Vang Jensen, Global Head of Logistics at Electrolux. Bjørn is a global industry figure, started his career as a graduate of the Maersk Shipping School and subsequently worked for the Maersk Group, then on the 3PL side for XL and TNT, and last 13 years as a proud leader of Electrolux supply chain team. All in all, Bjorn has lived in Asia for the past 30 years, across Thailand, Hong Kong, Japan, Malaysia, Philippines, and Singapore. Bjorn, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Radu.
So for today, we'll have our normal series of questions coming from our audience and ourselves. Broadly, supply chain related questions, talent and career development questions, as well as personal advice that Bjorn can share with our audience. So without further ado, Bjorn, let's start on the industry and supply chain side. So tell us a little bit about your success story in Electrolux. I mean, you've been with the company for roughly 13 years now, first as APEC vice president, now as a global logistics leader. Let's say, what have been two of your major breakthroughs in your supply chain over these years, and maybe share some insights for our audience in terms of what was the main learnings from it?
It's been a major journey, Radu. It's been a great privilege, I think, to be part of the Asian logistics and supply chain landscape for all those many years across all those countries and across all the modes, and both on the supply side and on the buy side. And the supply chain landscape in Asia has changed beyond all recognition in those 30 years. I was privileged to work in both developing countries in that period of very, very rapid development in Southeast Asia in the late 80s, early 90s, and contrast that with working in a highly developed country like Japan for almost 5 years with a very, very, very different kind of supply chain. Then back again via now very developed countries in Southeast Asia that were where the supply chain was changing from a very transactional to a much more strategic and planned network type of activity, and then finally ending up here on the buy side 13 years ago with Electrolux was maybe the biggest shift of them all. I think when you come from the supply side and you fancy yourself a bit of a student of supply chain practices, you can't wait to get over on the buy side and teach them everything about supply chain. And boy, was that a humbling experience coming into a manufacturing company, knowing well enough much about supply chain to defend myself on that score, but really having to learn a whole new world and how people within a manufacturing company think about supply chain, and how when you work on the supply side, there are so many aspects of the supply chain of a manufacturing company that you simply have never been exposed to. And so there really are not very many easy solutions. But you learn over the years, you adapt, and this is an exciting world. And of course, having the supply side background as well, I was able to tie the two together. So successes, two major breakthroughs in our supply chain, changes, I would say, rather than breakthroughs, changes, is of course globalization. When I joined Electrolux, yes, we certainly had a global footprint, but that global footprint was much more skewed towards having our own factories in local or regional markets and with component suppliers who were very close to those factories, again, locally or regionally. And, of course, going all the way back through you know, that very rapid globalization from 2004 to 2009 was a big shift to OEM manufacturing, to sourcing components far away in low-cost countries, to looking very closely at our own manufacturing footprint, which has been dramatically reduced in terms of number of factories and much more regionalized over all those years. And if I've been a part of that success, it's been in enabling that globalization by helping together with my team and a lot of dedicated players in the company and a lot of 3PLs and carriers, enabling that globalization by creating a strong global logistics network. While at the same time doing that with a team that's literally spread all over the world, we don't sit here in a big supply chain bunker in Singapore. My team of 22 logisticians are literally spread all over the world on every continent. That's been personally very rewarding for me to see that team grow. The vast majority of the team has been with me from day one. Wow. And so we have a huge base of experience now, and there are frankly very few things that can surprise us.
Yeah.
And very few things we can't deal with, I say, while knocking on wood. Insights that other supply chain leaders can work from, it's all about the team that you build and the trust that you place in your team and the autonomy you place in your team. You cannot run a globally responsible and globally based team unless you give serious autonomy levels to your team members. Mm. And of course, it goes without saying that this means you have to staff your team from day one with people who are worthy of that autonomy and whom you have a great deal of trust without having to manage them on a day-to-day basis. That's been a huge success, and that would be my advice to other global leaders.
Yeah, thank you for that. And we had a very good question from Abdullah, who was talking a little bit about the huge volumes that Electrolux obviously has. So he was saying that, of course, you have significant bargaining power to maintain direct carrier contacts. But would you say, Bjorn, moving forward, there are opportunities also for freight forwarders to add value to the Electrolux supply chain?
So it's a great question, and the answer, of course, is yes. But let me backtrack a little bit and talk about these volumes, because it is true that we do control an enormous amount of volumes, especially in terms of container trade. In the last 13 years, if you look at the Electrolux top line, it varies depending on exchange rate and global financial climates, somewhere between $15 and $18 billion a year.
Mm.
It's a pretty straight line depending on how you scale the y-axis, but if you then superimpose on that top line the development in containers that we have moved over the same period. We started 13 years ago with, let's say, 12,000-13,000 TEU. This year, for the first time, we will almost certainly break 200,000 TEU. That's a very interesting two lines to look at, right? Because what it's really saying is the top line, it changes a little bit here and there, but there's almost exponential growth in the volumes. And how is that? Well, that's globalization in two lines on a chart, right?
Yeah.
And I'm quite sure that many other companies see a very similar trend. But it is quite mind-blowing when you see that chart. What that means when you get up to this kind of volume, Abdullah is absolutely right. Of course, we have great leverage, and there is more sense for us in using carrier direct contracts, no doubt about it. The point here is that that's not necessarily just whether you use a forward or not. It's not a function of your volume. Mm. It's a function of your needs, and it's a function of your sensitivity to price. Okay, so with the average value of our containers being quite low, we are extremely sensitive to shipping rates. There's no doubt about it. That would be different from, for example, a shoe manufacturer or an electronics manufacturer who is not nearly as price sensitive because their products are smaller, they're higher value, and so they can carry a higher freight cost. And what we found when we've tried to engage freight forwarders purely in moving our containers is that none of them can get anywhere near by hundreds and hundreds of dollars per TEU the prices that we can get from carriers when we go carrier direct. And so it's very difficult, given our price sensitivity, to make the case for moving, using a freight forwarder. In our case, we have also chosen as a company to have a significant in-house capability on the supply chain management side, especially in Asia. And what that means is that the scope for freight forwarders on pure FCL finished products to come in and provide those services to us is quite limited, as many have discovered, and it's not for lack of trying that they've found that. Having said that, there are value-added services that freight forwarders provide that we avail ourselves of. We use freight forwarders, 3PLs, NVOs, call them what you want, for things like consolidation services, buyers consolidation in China. We, of course, use them for customs brokerage. We, of course, use freight forwarders for air freight. Naturally, for the expedited freight, we use the big courier companies. And as I would say for Electrolux, that's kind of where the scope is for a freight forwarding company. but other companies may be very different.
Yeah. Right? And probably for the contract logistics side, right?
Yeah. That's where we're a mixture, I would say, and that varies quite significantly by region. We're a mixture of in-house operations of our distribution centers and outsourced operations.
Mm-hmm.
But there are multiple opportunities there, especially in the multi-user space, and also on the transport side. Let's touch on that. I mean, if you really look at the global Electrolux spend on logistics, as near as we can tell, because
yeah.
it's sometimes difficult to
gauge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To gauge, but we are right there where most modern industrial companies are. So somewhere around 10% of the top line, right? So that would make it probably around $1.5 billion a year. I would venture a guess that 80% of that is road and rail transport and warehousing, regionally and domestically in single countries, right? So there are huge opportunities there as well for NVOs and freight forwarders to address.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's also what we're seeing in terms of the industry in general, the 3PL industry. I think that more or less all of them or some of them are trying to be more of a solution provider, and freight is a commodity, or it's become very commodity.
Freight is a commodity, and I think you know, when I have conversations with freight forwarders around ocean freight, most of them will tell you today that it's not actually the arbitrage on the freight that they make money on. It's the surcharges and the ancillary services and the origin charges, the destination charges. It's not the freight arbitrage, because right. I think if you have a freight forwarding company today and you're basing your business model on ocean freight arbitrage, then I don't think you'll have a long and happy life.
No, stormy waters ahead, yeah. Devin Hembeck asked technology questions, of course. Technologies is we talk about it every day nowadays. So technology for logistics and supply chain, as technology for logistics and supply chain develops, what are the top three benefits you see coming from technology?
So again, it's a question that it's impossible to answer as a broad answer that holds true for everyone, right?
Mm.
That's impossible. For me, I think the three benefits from technology that we're seeing in global logistics is that visibility is getting better and better.
Mm.
You have more and more players out there providing visibility at a very, very granular level for much less money than it used to cost to get that visibility. The problem with the visibility is, of course, that it's garbage in, garbage out, right? So if you don't have the input, the EDI messages from your service providers and your suppliers and your own people are not sent timely or they're wrong, well, then, you know, it doesn't really matter how granular your visibility is, right? And here I think there are still many, many challenges, particularly on the carrier side. It's not a problem to get the initial visibility. The problem is as things change, as goods move through the supply chain, something goes wrong, the speed with which your service providers update and adjust your visibility tool varies greatly. Ocean carriers are generally quite terrible at it. 3PLs are generally much better at it. And here you can go back to the previous question and say there is maybe a case for using NVOs and freight forwarders because they do that for a living.
Right? Yeah.
So that's kind of number one. I mean, visibility has come such a long way. And number two it kind of dovetails with visibility is risk management, right? Because what we're doing, what we have been doing, not just Electrolux, but all companies who have gone through rapid globalization is, of course, that we've done to our supply chain what no supply chain textbook will ever recommend that you do, right? I mean, the fundamental tenet of supply chain management is the closer you can have everything to your point of consumption, or the further you can delay the customization before the point of consumption, the more robust and predictable and inventory light is your supply chain. Of course, what we've all done is the exact opposite, right? We've exploded our supply chains into the furthest reaches of the world in search of low cost or other benefits, scale benefits, and with that comes very significant risk. Right? Yeah. Your lead times get longer, your pipelines get longer, small accidents at the furthest reach of the supply chain is amplified beyond all comprehension by the time that the consequences reach the point of consumption. And so visibility and risk management go hand in hand, but it's not just about knowing where my stuff is. It's also managing, for example, your portfolio of service providers. Again, let me go back to ocean freight, obviously near and dear to my heart. The alliances that we've seen spring up now that have reduced choice for people like us, it's not just about reducing pricing options. It's also about reducing choice and reducing risk. And you can now sort of kid yourself that you have actually chosen three different suppliers, but it turns out that they're all using the same shit.
Right? Yeah.
And so risk management, and we're seeing a plethora of risk management software coming out now as well that aims to help with that. Some of those solutions are better than others. Some are more relevant to some industries than others. But certainly risk management. Let's just say, without the technology we have now, it wouldn't be very much fun to try and manage our U.S. supply chain in the wake of Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Harvey.
Yeah.
But because we have the technology we have, these things get easier. They get easier.
Yeah.
And the third, I think, and I'm a huge advocate of this, the third exciting technology to come out really is blockchain. Blockchain is on everyone's mind right now and for very, very good reason. Supply chain management and logistics are incredibly documentation heavy undertakings. And any opportunity we can take to go paperless or to move onto a distributed database technology like blockchain. Think of the potential to eliminate written purchase orders. Think of the potential to eliminate the bill of lading, the Seaway bill. All these archaic documents that we really ought to have fixed a long time ago. I think blockchain holds real promise. So I'm telling everyone who will listen and my own team as well, if you don't make it your business to learn about blockchain, I would actually question your commitment to developing yourself within this industry, because it's coming and it's going to be big.
Yeah. No, and that brings me to the point, because I think, blockchain is going to be a leeway for our next question. Blockchain is on a lot of people's lips. A lot of people talk about it. Some people are doing things about it. I think IBM is leading the way, and they've announced a couple of very significant case studies with Maersk. With Walmart, I saw. Mm-hmm. So it's coming. It's coming faster, I think, than maybe some people realize. Like you said, let's talk a little bit, just briefly, more about what. You've spoken a little bit about the impact, but what else do you think will change and will see by 2020 in terms of blockchain implications?
In terms of blockchain, I think much will depend on where we choose to apply this technology first, right? Like with any other potentially disruptive technology, it's all about whether it hits the sweet spot from day one and then it spreads like rings in the sand. Let's take, for example, something that excited people to no end 12, 13, 14 years ago, RFID, right? Mm-hmm. RFID was the new black. There was, everything was going to have an RFID. Every bottle of shampoo on a supermarket shelf was going to have an RFID chip on it. And we wouldn't even have to do anything other than smile at the cashier as we rolled our shopping trolleys out of the supermarket, because everything would have already been read and our credit card would already have been charged, right? Well, that didn't really happen, right?
Yeah.
What did happen, what ultimately drove the success of RFID, were a few big players that insisted that their suppliers use RFID. Walmart, I think, led that charge back then. But even so, costs held it back. And so RFID sort of lived a little bit of a backwater existence compared to its initial huge promise, simply because costs held it back. The cost of the chips, the cost of the scanners, the difficulty of implementation. Blockchain is a little bit different in that there really isn't a whole lot of cost and difficulty of implementation. This is not a physical thing where you have to make sure that all packaging has now got to be redesigned to contain RFID chips and all that sort of stuff. This is about finding that sweet spot. And I think it's all about freight documentation. If we can start with freight documentation, and that is exactly what IBM and Maersk are doing together, right? They're trying to attack
the most painful, yet slammed, the most bureaucratic
most painful,
and painful.
The most bureaucratic, but also the most slam dunk application whatsoever. Get rid of documentation, because that documentation frequently gets lost today. And let me tell you what, if you lose a bill of lading or you lose a weight bill, the repercussions can be huge and expensive, right?
Yeah.
And it ought to be easy to make that go away. So those who really want to move blockchain forward, two things. First of all, find the sweet spot, a pain point where blockchain is the obvious solution. And then don't try and attack the whole world and change the whole world overnight, because that's not going to happen. Find, you know, what a famous politician once called the coalition of the willing. Make it happen. And then it'll spread like rings in the water. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're beginning to see it. And of course, as always, and with change in general, we humans are creatures of habit, so we don't like to change.
No.
Plus, there are some deep political implications, administration implications. There's jobs on the line. Of course, these people that push these papers around.
No,
so they
absolutely.
Be very happy and supportive of this.
Absolutely. But that's also why, I was at a conference once, maybe a year ago, where Maersk was, they had an example that said, we've investigated how much paper is involved in moving a shipment of cocoa from Nigeria to Rotterdam. And he pulled out a stack of paper. He said, there's about 37 centimeter tall stack of paper that's ultimately involved from the seller starts selling until the buyer has the cocoa. And that was a very interesting example. I don't know whether there were 300 pages of documents, something like that. But to me, it was, yes, that was interesting. And for a wow factor, it's cool. But that's not where you're going to start your implementation then, is it? Mm. Right, because as you correctly say, those 300 pieces of paper, especially in economies, in developing countries, you're right. There is a lot of money, and there are a lot of jobs attached to those pieces of paper. Mm. What you need to find is, in my opinion, and we need to start implementing it, is from developed countries to other developed countries, countries that probably already have enacted between them and for themselves a significant liberalization of requirements. So I could see, you know, from China to the US, I could see from Europe to the US, US to Europe. Let's start it there.
And I think Singapore,
rather than trying to find the biggest beast in the jungle and attack that, because you'll never do it.
Start small. And Singapore, I think, will also
Singapore,
have a very
absolutely.
Important part
definitely,
of that.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. I mean, it's we just got to get a few of the success stories out, but start, and then it will roll on.
Absolutely.
Super. Good question from Nabil. E-commerce is growing. It's growing everywhere, all over the world. What is Electrolux doing in terms of reaching your customers via e-commerce channels?
Well, Amazon is being mentioned here, and we are a proud business partner of Amazon in many parts of the world, predominantly in Europe and North America. I think if you're an Electrolux, you find yourself or in a similar industry as ours, you find yourself in an interesting sort of a little bit between a rock and a hard place. it is very clear that that developing, you know, an Amazon-like distribution network on your own is a fool's errand.
Yeah. Right?
The costs are astronomical. We don't have the volume. We don't. It's a pure scale game, e-commerce, right? And so it's really going to be more a question of which horses do you bet on, right? We've so far bet on Amazon and on Alibaba. But the other hard place that you're up against is that we, of course, remain a big box retailer supplier in a very, very big way. Our largest 20 largest customers are all the big retailers in the world, right? Whether it's IKEA, it's Lowe's, it's Sears, it's Walmart, it's you know, a whole host of out here in Asia, Harvey Normans and Good Guys, and you know, there is a tension in the air because, of course, we have to be very careful that we don't anger the retailers by shifting too much through the e-commerce channel. On the other hand, we also have to leverage scale in the e-commerce channel. So there's a balancing act there. I'm not sure we've finished with calibrating.
Yeah.
But at the root of this question is, does Electrolux believe that e-commerce is coming? And I can tell, yeah, we believe e-commerce is coming. We have digitalization and e-commerce, and not just the e-commerce in terms of the sales transaction.
Yeah.
And obviously e-commerce in terms of the logistics transaction, the physical delivery and the installation. It's not just about that. E-commerce has a whole different promise in terms of tying in a consumer to you on what we call the 360 consumer journey. If you imagine an infinity loop, you know, somewhere in on any given point in that loop, you can put the sale. But after that comes the onboarding, the ongoing experience, the servicing, the addition of services and accessories,
reverse and logistics, returns, repairs, yeah,
and then ultimately, of course, hopefully the consumer continues along that infinity loop and comes back to where the next sale occurs. And e-commerce holds tremendous promise for us to develop that even further. We've also made a couple of e-commerce related acquisitions. Of course, last year we bought a small company called Anova. Anova makes sous vide cookers based out of San Francisco. And Anova is nearly 100% B2C under their own steam. And that's been a tremendous learning for us working with these people. And it's quite interesting that the small company with 27 employees.
27
employees and a whole bunch of contractors, of course.
Absolutely.
Something like that, fixed employees, is actually almost single-handedly transforming the way people across Electrolux are thinking about how we communicate, how we manage e-commerce. It's been such a revelation.
That's impressive.
Yeah, very, very impressive. But it's also a very impressive company, also a very impressive product, which you should, of course, purchase. on AnovaCulinary.com.
2 seconds commercial.
Yes.
No, but I mean that's incredible, actually. I mean, what a story, right?
And it is a great story.
We had also Charles Brewer, the CEO of DHL e-commerce, in one of our previous podcasts, and because you said that the e-commerce is coming, actually probably e-commerce is already here and it's just going to grow, and Charles was saying that the train has left the station. I mean, now you better get on the train or get hit by the train. There's no two ways around it.
Yeah, we'll be left on the station.
Yeah, we'll be left on the station. Yeah, I mean, it's there's whole deserted streets in the US of empty shops. It's happening at the large scale across the world.
Absolutely. And across the world. When you are over, I mean, I just spent a couple of months over in the US actually on sort of a combined holiday and business, during which we rented a couple of houses, but almost never visited a shop during the time we were there. I mean, you know, half the time you would order something on Amazon in the morning, and by 1 p.m. there'd be a guy going, "I have a package for Bjorn Jensen." You're like, "What?"
That's fantastic.
Okay, yeah, right.
I mean, and I mean, okay, U.S. is a great story, but also China, you know, and what Alibaba is, and the capabilities of logistics that they have, it's just
unreal. Phenomenal.
Brita has an interesting question as well. So, did you already at Electrolux consider using the empty space in washing machine to fill it with other shipping? shipped items?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. I mean, it's a good question, Brisa. It's a creative question. It's a question we asked actually many years ago. We looked at it, I think, about 10 years ago, whether we could, for example, put smaller appliances inside larger appliances and thus utilizing the empty space. Because it is very true that when you ship 200,000 containers a year, you're shipping a ridiculous amount of air.
Yeah.
Imagine chest freezers and whatever. It's almost a ratio of 1 to 9 product to air. And refrigerators are the same. Perhaps washers and dryers, not so much, but definitely it was something we looked at. We found it to be impractical. Maybe Electrolux specific, but the products that we had that could fit inside larger appliances belonged to a different division, which has had and still has a very different supply chain footprint from major appliances, which meant that we would then have to start introducing deconsolidation centers, redistribution, double or triple or quadruple handling. And when you do the trade-off calculation on that versus the shipping costs that you could have saved, it turns out that it's a non-starter.
Mm.
The other thing, of course, is that when you do stuff like that, and we actually made some trial runs, the damage rate goes up through the roof, right? Because, you can't have stuff that's rattling around inside a refrigerator. It damages the refrigerator and potentially also the product. It just wasn't practical.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely. Good question.
Yeah.
Didn't work for us. Might work for others, but for us it turned out to not work for all kinds of reasons.
So, Brita, if you're thinking of trying it, tread with care,
tread
or
carefully.
do the case study.
This is a creative proposal, but at its heart, it's a proposal that just addresses stuff that's already big on people's minds, which is the question of consolidation. There's nothing wrong with consolidation; it can save you a ton of money, but you do need to when you look at consolidation initiatives, you have to look at the additional logistics costs that you are introducing into the process, and is there really a trade-off there? Right?
Yeah,
in our
case,
there wasn't.
Yeah. Matthew Gallagher is asking, back to the freight forwarders, a very, very straight question, Bjorn. Do you think that freight forwarders are dead men walking? And with all the tech talk, who will pay for the investment before we see the return?
No, I don't think freight forwarders are dead men walking. It's a little bit of a similar question to the question we had very early on around, where is there room for freight forwarders in the supply chain? There's absolutely room for freight forwarders. I don't see it. First of all, just because there are some large customers who develop in-house capability doesn't mean that there aren't a whole lot of SMEs and medium-sized and small customers that don't have the need for freight forwarding services. We also have need for freight forwarding services. The question is, which services do the freight forwarders base their business model on? Again, if they base it on pure freight arbitrage, then they probably are dead men walking. But I don't know any freight forwarder today that's basing the business model on freight arbitrage, right? Which kind of brings you to the second question, second part of Matthew's question, right? With all the tech talk, who will pay for the investment before we see the return? So Matthew kind of answers his own question. Tech is technology, and providing technology is the price of entry today for a freight forwarder. Who will pay for that investment? The freight forwarder. I've been on the supply side as well. I know that exactly what Matthew is talking about. These solutions are costly, and it's very difficult to create a business case for them because fundamentally the business case rests on build it and they will come, or we hope they will come, right?
No, which is a risky.
Yeah, but on the other hand, that's. Yes, that's a risk that a freight forwarder will have to take, but that's a risk that any business will have to take. It's a risk that a shipping line takes when they go out and order 11 new ships for a new string. They certainly hope that there will be a demand. That's a risk we take when we build a factory or when we make investments in new tooling or new technologies. So if if what Matthew's really asking is how can we pay for it up front, the answer is we can't. This is a business risk that you have to take, just like any other business. Certain technologies are absolutely the price of entry, I think, almost no matter who you want to do business with. Other more advanced technology, I would be careful with investing in, especially when you get onto the risk management side of things. I'd invest in that alongside with the customer, because there are too many solutions out there. We have not yet seen the market distill.
Actually, we're far from that. Actually, at this moment,
I'm inundated on my LinkedIn profile with people trying to sell me all kinds of tech solutions, and it's great. And I'm grateful that they reach out, although I do wish they would, you know, reach out in a slightly more focused manner. But this tells me that there are so many people out there trying to find, you know, the next great app, right?
Yeah,
And it's the market has not distilled yet at all.
Yeah, and just to add to your point, and I mean, I guess it's also what I know, and from what I'm also seeing on my side in the industry, the closer the partnership, and there's a few of these, I mean, successful, very successful partnerships between 3PLs and shippers in the world, the better, and the more they can jointly work together. And of course, then as a 3PL, you can lock sort of the client for a longer time. And of course, there should be a trade-off, but that's the way to do it. And as you rightfully said, I mean, you need to have, as a 3PL, I think, I mean, increasingly, they need to have a strategy around the solution and design a solution and bet on it.
If you are in any type of business now, 3PL, manufacturing, or anything else, and you are not spending every single day thinking about how to digitalize your operations, then I think you should do your company a favor and retire.
Absolutely. Also, on the flip side, good. You know, it's a good question to leeway is okay. We talked about technology, but before we even go and invest millions and billions into digital and new tech and all of that, what do you believe are the fundamentals? Right, the really core fundamentals of a supply chain in today's environment.
In today's environment, if we take that to mean a globalized supply chain,
yeah.
We keep going back to visibility. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to have that absolute fundamental. You have to have the EDI capability. You must have some kind of visibility platform. I would recommend going with one of the really big ones, because I think a lot of the really small ones are going to go away. A lot of them are startups. Startups are risky. We've gone with GT Nexus, but there are many other platforms out there that are equally good. That would be, you know, get your EDI capability up and running, get your visibility up and running, and then start thinking hard about your e-commerce platform and how can you service that, right? If you're a service provider right now, again, we're still in Matthew's question. I believe Matthew is with a 3PL. Here we really can talk about being left at the station if you don't invest, right? I mean, that's one of the things that I've learned quickly. It's amazing. I still have lots to learn. When I got involved in the integration of the acquisition of Anova into Electrolux, I mean, very often my team are the first boots on the ground when we've made an acquisition, simply because
you have to. I mean, the backbone. Yeah.
Well, first of all, generally. Very few people, very few companies we acquire have any objections to getting integrated into our logistics network, because it tends to save them tons of money and we've turned it into a fine art. So you can do it very quickly and you get very, very quick results, right? So, but I was absolutely astonished when I set foot and sat down and talked to these people about how they've managed a pure B2C business that ships over 1 million units a year individually, usually by courier, from 4 different fulfillment centers in the world, and the technology that they used to do that with was all outsourced.
Wow.
Few platforms, I can't name them here because I really don't want to, you know, do free advertising, but a couple of service providers who have who have really bet farm on being able to manage the entire process. I'm also talking about the order taking process. I'm not just talking about the fulfillment. I'm talking about the order
end taking, end to end almost.
The visibility, the inventory visibility, the ocean freight, the ultimate picking, packing, delivery, and all the technology it takes to manage that. And what was astonishing to me was not only that, that these companies had invested in that technology, but that they were essentially giving it away. Hmm. There was no additional charge for using that.
Hmm.
That's built into whatever handling fees
you're paying already.
You're paying, but you know, gone are the days when a 3PL could come to a client and say, well, we can do all of this. And then, by the way, on a cost-plus basis, we also need you to invest up front $300,000 or $400,000 in the warehouse management system. Right? That was always a hard sell. Trust me, I've had to try and make it on a few occasions. It's very difficult to make. Now we're seeing business models where service providers, and that includes, by the way, also, of course, Charles's outfit, saying, well, that we know that's the price of entry. That is part of our service offering. And we will just have to find a way to get paid through our handling fees.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So visibility, EDI capability, and if you want to play, you know, you have to go and find yourself an e-commerce platform that you can provide to your customers. Now, yeah. 5 years, it'll be too late.
Yeah. No, yeah, you don't have, nobody has 5 years anymore.
Nope.
Final question on this segment. If you were an investor, which supply chain technology related startup would you invest in and why?
Startup? That's a good question. I'd rather not name companies. I already answered the question. Yeah. I would find those that I really believe in, who've already gotten traction in integrated e-commerce platforms that they either provide themselves or that they license to service providers or companies. I think that's got really got legs.
Mm.
That's what I would invest in.
Mm.
But as to whom I would invest in, I honestly don't know.
And we might, I mean, you touched upon it a little bit as well. I mean, there's a lot of different players still. I mean, there's no few obvious ones.
No.
So, I mean,
I would definitely,
in a few years,
in terms of which supply chain technology I would invest in, unequivocally e-commerce platform, mm-hmm. integrated e-commerce platforms.
Yeah.
Farm to table type of
solution. This is the end of part one. Stay tuned for part two, where we talk more about recruitment, talent, and skills gaps.